This episode is brought to you by Berry Bisop, a refreshing West African spiced hibiscus tea.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Amrit Richmond and Stephen Vigilante, who are friends and CPG gurus who created Indie CPG, a global community of over 500 brand founders building better consumer and lifestyle brands. Amrit is also a CPG consultant working with brands and investors through her agency, CMYK Ventures. Stephen is the growth marketing manager at Olipop and advises brands on fundraising and strategy. The two of you guys together are like a force, and I'm so glad you're on the show. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
These things are so, it's so hard not in person because you don't know when like someone's kind of handing you the baton. So there's always these like slightly awkward silences, especially with two guests. But we are going to do our best to avoid that.
I feel like that's what everyone in the world's been dealing with the last five months.
I know. And I had a couple of episodes, Matt knows, where like I couldn't like get my microphone to work and I sound like I'm in some sort of basement, you know, under a tarp somewhere, like trying to record the thing. Like this podcast has had, let's put it this way. I'm appreciative of all the people that are continuing to listen despite the fact that we are not in the studio. But Amrit, back to you. I met you through Stephen, and then you helped me with my deck, which was amazing. And when we were getting to know each other a little bit, it was right around Expo, and I know your mom has restaurants or a restaurant, and I know she's been a long-term entrepreneur, but you're also, you said something, I don't remember if you said it to me or if I read it or I heard it, but you said something like, the grocery store is your Disneyland. And I think that's when I, you know, fell in love basically with you. So tell me a little bit about your journey, I guess, how you got into doing what you're doing, how you got to be able to work with brands. And for everyone who hasn't listened to this podcast, CPG is consumer packaged goods. Matt, I know we have said the acronym a lot. Just in the last 2 minutes. So that's what it means. Amrit, I'm handing you the mic.
All right. So consumer goods have been a big part of my life since I was a kid. First through my mom, she had her own frozen food line, has launched multiple restaurants, and has developed recipes for snack and beverage brands. And when she had a frozen food line, she would bring me along as a 10-year-old to demo her brand at Whole Foods and Expo West. So when I say Whole Foods is like my Disneyland, it was where I hung out as a kid. If my mom was demoing, I would be roaming through the other aisles, looking at her competition, looking at things I wanted to snack on, just really roaming the aisles to understand what else was out there to help my mom. And seeing Expo West evolve over 20 years alongside all of the new brands and innovation got me really interested in focusing on CPG, specifically natural CPG brands for my agency. As a consumer, I love plant-based foods and low-sugar, high-protein snacks, but it's exciting to see so many new kinds of consumers experimenting with different flavors and ingredients, and just in general being open to the delight of trying something new, which is what we're all striving towards, is getting people to try our products. Mm-hmm. So as a consultant, I help brands really understand who their customer is, sometimes talking directly to your customer or working backwards from who we think the customer is, where do they shop, what other brands do they like, really trying to understand the customer journey and also the ecosystem around a brand. And for investors in CPG companies, I help the investors understand some of these things or support their founders on behalf of the fund.
Right. Great. Stephen, you have one of those incredible backgrounds that I think brands are looking for, where you were an investor. And then in order, I think I've kind of made this up, I don't know if this is real, but like not to just sort of be an investor, but to really understand what the brands and the entrepreneurs and the founders and the teams are experiencing, you switched over to the operating side. And I think that that combination is really your sweet spot. But maybe tell me a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, sure. It's funny. I almost feel like the opposite of Amrit, where I grew up like the pickiest eater ever, kind of eating standard American diet, New Jersey. I was the kid, like, you know, putting like ketchup on pasta and like only ordering chicken fingers at nice restaurants, driving my parents nuts. And I kind of found my way into consumer into the CPG space in college. I went to Penn State, and Penn State has like a student run mutual fund on campus. And I kind of got got into it as a sophomore and ended up running the consumer sector of the fund as a junior. And I like totally fell in love with doing homework and, you know, reading research reports on these big consumer packaged goods companies that like are so pervasive in our lives but most people don't know much about.
Yeah.
And so I kind of came into it from that lens. I'm actually really interested in psychology broadly, and I took advanced placement psychology in high school and again in college. And consumer to me is kind of an exercise, especially consumer investing, is kind of an exercise in psychology and like what makes people tick and
100%.
why would you buy one product over another. And so I kind of came into it from that lens, not through the lens of health and wellness. And then I moved to San Francisco after I graduated college, and I was doing investment banking, and then joined a company called Circle Up that was like an equity crowdfunding marketplace for early stage consumer brands, and actually met a guy who worked there as well, who was like a finance guy, had gone to Harvard, but was vegan. And, you know, I had never like met another vegan, to be honest. Right. And he convinced me to watch a movie called Cowspiracy. And that's what kind of got me on my health and wellness journey. I saw the like impact on the environment that, you know, meat and meat production has. And that's what really pushed me down into this, you know, health and wellness space. And so, I had 3 years at Circle Up. It was a great experience. You know, I always tell people I meet like 20 to 30 founders every week. We raised a fund while I was there, which was at the time back in 2016, 2017, was one of the first, you know, seed funds specifically focused on food, beverage and health and wellness. And you know, it was kind of one of those things. I was right place, right time, you know, 24, 25 years old, and had an opportunity to join as one of the first associates on the investment team there, and just got an amazing experience, and it was cool. And I actually helped lead an investment in Miyoko's Kitchen, which was
she was on.
Miyoko's great. She's amazing.
She's amazing.
Total shining light in the industry.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like a direct result of like watching Cowspiracy and getting into plant-based before it was like everywhere like it is
right
now. And so, yeah, I can kind of dive further into the journey if it makes sense. But yeah,
well,
3 years ago, I moved down to LA to get some operating experience on the brand side. And it's been an amazing ride ever since.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit? I mean, Olipop is like sort of, they just seem to have, or you just seem to have done it all right. I mean, talk about the psychology, like, I don't even necessarily love soda, and I just want to look at those cans in my refrigerator. Like it's so compelling. And I mean, it's functional, which is great. And I understand, you know, the fiber piece is like important, but there's just something about the brand too, that's just so winning. And I'm just curious, you know, anything you want to tell me about it, any kind of North Star that you guys have or some sort of underlying, you know, just mantra, you know.
People ask this question all the time. to be honest. And it's what's interesting. I had actually gone to another startup after I left the investing world that had, you know, raised $45+ million and went through it in less than 8 months and actually went under in June of 2018. And it was a tough experience for me personally. And I kind of got to watch something kind of disintegrate from the inside out. And it was very culture driven. It was just not a great place to be. There was a lot of issues with the business. And when I met shortly after that folded, I met Ben and David, who are working on this prebiotic soda. And it was one of those things for me, like, as I think about, you know, from an investment perspective, you know, big categories that are kind of old and stagnant and don't really have like a better for you alternative in them are kind of categories that have done really well. You see Halo Top, what they did in ice cream, and, you know, like a Bonza in pasta, and even what Cauli Power Pizza has done in the frozen pizza space. Ben and David were trying to do that in soda. No one had really cracked the code on healthy soda. There's, you know, kombucha, sparkling water, tea, juice, lots of innovation in beverage broadly, but I don't think anyone would argue those are like one-for-one substitutes for a root beer or a cola. And cola's $60 billion+ category globally. And it's one of those things, if you can like nail a root beer, right, that tastes like a root beer and is truly functionally beneficial, not just less bad for you, but truly functionally good for you. It's like, to me, I was like, oh my God, this is like an amazing opportunity. And kind of came on board as a consultant to help raise some money initially. But it has been this kind of crazy rocket ship over the last 2 years. And the number one thing I think it kind of comes down to, and why a lot of that brand stuff that you can't necessarily put your finger on, you know, that you're asking about. And I actually think a lot of it comes down to our team culture. It's literally the best organizational culture of like, not just company I've worked at, but like any group or team I've ever been on. And everyone is so on the same page, and there's so much cross-functional collaboration. It's incredible. I actually wrote a Slack message to the team over the weekend. I was just kind of like a thank you. It's so cool to work on so many different work streams across multiple, like I feel like I'm working on projects with like 12 different people internally. Yeah. And everyone is amazing. It's awesome. And it's one of those that I've kind of spent some time in with, like, as an example, Sir Kensington's. I feel like if you've ever talked to anyone who's ever worked at Sir Kensington's, they would all they would talk about was how great of a place it was to work. And I think that's like one of the primary reasons brands kind of succeed or fail after they've had some product market fit is scale. And we're just about 20 people at Olipop now, and like the team is just so incredible. It's awesome.
That's so interesting. I want to get into how you guys met and sort of like how you sort of started this community and why. But I do think it's worth noting, like, one of the things that you said in there, I mean, first of all, I had Scott, the founder, and Pat Jame on the podcast. And they were like mythical in
from Sir Kensington's,
sort of, right? Kensington's, like, the team, just the team. And a lot of that was also Pat's, like, the field marketing team were just like, they just lived and breathed getting people to try, you know, the products. But I think one of the things you said in there was also about cross-functional, which is interesting because we were talking, you know, my team is still, we're six now, and we all have, you know, our morning Zoom calls. And one of the things that's been actually really interesting and sort of fun about working remotely and having to do everything on Zoom is today the ops team basically gave the marketing team a little bit of lesson in how, like, UNFI purchase orders work. And, you know, like, they didn't know, you know, and so the more that the, you know, sort of the outward facing team knows about how the sort of the back office works, and vice versa, the more you can, I think the richer everything is. And 100%. When you have teams where there's like this real bifurcation and almost this like tension between ops and marketing, where the ops are always like, no, that's too much money. And the marketing is always like, but let's just try it because we can't really, you know, that's when I think things internally get uncomfortable. Is that kind of what you mean by that cross-functional?
Yeah, a perfect example too. We have a Monday morning call as well every week, and we have a different kind of department runs it each week and kind of gives an update. And this morning we had like a sales update, and so each kind of regional sales rep kind of ran through their region and the wins in each region and who the distributors are and where we're consolidating things. And it's so interesting. Because I think everybody in the business needs to know how all that stuff works. Like if ops and sales aren't talking, like you can go out and sell all this product, but if you're not like 3 months ahead of schedule, 6 months ahead of schedule, buying ingredients and getting like the production schedules in line. And then, you know, e-commerce now is a you know, significant portion of our business. And there's ramifications there as we deal with like with out of stocks. And we want to run like a promotion or a discount, or we're going to push something, like you have to be thinking like 3 months ahead basically.
Just knowing the why, you know, why is it important that we do well when we, you know, launch in Kroger? Like, well, we understand basically it's good to do well everywhere, but really why, you know? And then you can kind of go down each thread of the business and sort of explain what the positive impact of each thing is and what the potentially negative impact of each thing is, which, you know, I think is fun on a small team. I would imagine it's harder on a bigger team, but I think that's a very cool, you know, gist.
Yeah, there is some like whatever. You talk to people who've kind of been there before and have scaled brands. There's, you know, we're just about 20 people at Olipop, and it was like, you know, a certain threshold and challenge of scaling from 0 to 20, and then 20 to 50 is like has its own, you know, challenges that come with it, where not everybody can know everything that's going on in the business, and you know, there's layers and so stuff like that. So that's kind of our next hurdle that we're going to cross as a team.
So you guys met in 2017. So you were both sort of on your individual journeys, and then Stephen, you reached out to Amrit. You guys took a walk at Whole Foods and became friends.
I think it was a Twitter message.
Stephen reached out after reading some of my CPG content, and he basically told me, I think we should meet. I think we'd have a lot to talk about, and we'd become friends. and it was really short and sweet. It was just an invitation to connect with somebody that's as passionate about you are about CPG. And of course, I said yes, and we quickly became friends.
There's a special group of us that like literally like go to grocery stores to hang out, not just the grocery shop.
By the way, like I would so want to be in that group. I love the grocery store. Like, have always loved the grocery store. So I'm just inviting myself into your
group. I mean, it's like a little, you know, secret society of people hang out in grocery stores. But you meet like enough people. A lot of people, if you work in this industry, you're probably one of those people, right?
Yes.
And that's why everyone loves coming to LA, because they get to go to Erewhon, and Erewhon's kind of like the mecca of the culty grocery stores. I'd say Erewhon and Whole Foods, of course. But I love giving Erewhon tours in LA. It's always a riot.
So you guys basically, you have newsletters, you co-host events, you share resources. I think one of the things that you do that I think is kind of cool is just like, I don't think that I really realized how important and how productive partnerships could be, really until I'd say even like about a year ago. I really didn't understand the brand partnership thing. It seemed just like, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't really understand it, but now I feel like it's such an important part of building a brand and creating sort of an ecosystem that you live in, where your consumer kind of knows where you live, going back to sort of your psychology part. And I think one of the things that it seems like you do is you do sort of say, these are like-minded brands, or these are brands that you work together with, and you sort of make connections. But would you say the biggest thing is the newsletter? Like, what would you sort of say is like the sort of the biggest output of Indie CPG?
I would say the newsletter, and Stephen and I do a lot of behind the scenes work, that we're not doing it to get credit for. We're doing it because we love to support our friends and brands we admire. So people may not have heard about it. Like, we do office hours a lot. If a friend just wants to jam on something, maybe they want feedback on their pitch deck, or they're launching in a new city and they want to know who in our collective network they could talk to. Or there's usually some kind of goal with someone reaching out to us within this community, and we're always happy to help. And if we don't have the answer, we'll admit that, and we'll say, you should actually talk to this person, right? Because they did that functionality at this other brand that they were at, or they consult on this, or they only invest in blank. So Stephen and I play switchboard operator a lot, just making sure that people are getting to the source of what they need.
Right.
And building community is a great way to scale that effort. So if we host a video chat, we did one with a sales leader a few months ago, and we were able to get 20 founders on there just to talk privately about hiring their first chief sales officer. And there isn't a lot of other opportunity for those people to meet each other, but also for the mentor to give back in a setting where he feels like he's contributing something too. And that scales everybody's time. So things like that, we hope to do more of, especially while we can't meet in person as much.
Yeah.
And the long-term goal with all of these resources and content that we produce for IndieCPG is to give the next generation of sustainable food and beverage brands the same kind of resources they might get from a fund post-investment.
Right.
But there are a lot of people that don't have access to venture-backed resources, mm-hmm. for whatever reason. It's totally acceptable to never raise money for your business, but you still need to find peers and mentors and collaborators and vetted agencies and all these little decisions that founders like Allison think about every day. We hope to catalog some of that to help you build faster and more thoughtfully.
Yeah, I kind of call it like connecting the dots. Like when you start a food or beverage company, there's just a host of people that you kind of need to know who they are to work your way through the system. And when you're new, it's when you're a new founder, it's like challenging, right? This is not an industry where like candidly, like you can Google a lot of stuff. It's like a lot of, right. You got to talk to people and figure out how they've hacked their way through, you know, an UNFI contract or, you know, getting in front of like Nosh and BevNet and stuff like that. And
yeah.
I've just always kind of been hardwired like that. When I was on the investing side, I'd always try to go out of my way. I worked a lot with the portfolio companies after we invested to like connecting them to various industry partners. And, you know, we'd have a direct line into like this head snack buyer at Starbucks, as an example, and kind of making intros like that. And Omri's the same way. We're just kind of hardwired to help people out and go above and beyond. And
I love it. You're like tour guides. I feel like I've said this before, but I feel like starting the sauce company, just like I landed in a foreign country. I was sort of like dropped in from a plane and kind of landed in the middle of some sort of square, and everyone was speaking a language I didn't get. And there were all these different dialects, because by the way, one acronym means something at one store, but a totally different acronym at another store. And you're like, you're not only learning like one language, you're learning all these dialects. And you don't, I mean, I didn't know what a promo was, you know, and why did you have to go on promotion? Doesn't that make it look like you need to go on sale? That was, you know, which is, you just don't know. So you guys are sort of translators and tour guides. For me, it's been great getting to know you. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about all of the mistakes that you've seen, and all of the, you know, sort of ways to, I think, mitigate and avoid those mistakes. So we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Berry Bisop. Bisop is a refreshing West African spiced hibiscus tea. Berry Bisop honors and preserves the traditional recipe while adding their own twist. Berry Bisop teas are fused with organic fruit. They're all natural, caffeine-free, ethically sourced, and free from artificial coloring or any other chemicals. As for taste, they're chilled and refreshing with a hint of both sweetness and tartness. Drink them alone or mix them with seltzer or cocktails. Learn more at berrybisop.com. That's Berry, BISSAP.com.
I'm back with Stephen and Amrit from IndieCPG. Okay. So you guys have had a lot of exposure and a lot of experience to brands doing it well, brands not doing it so well, teams. I would say I'd like from each of you 1 to 3 common mistakes that you feel like you are like, oh, I wish someone had just told them this? Amrit, let's start with you.
Some misconceptions that I see in the industry are one, that plant-based food isn't just for vegans and vegetarians anymore. And if you're thinking about investing in that space or building a company in that space, your total addressable market is anybody that is looking for those flavor profiles or high protein. It's not necessarily about sustainability or other reasons why someone might eat a veggie burger, but it's permeated into pop culture. It's at fast food restaurants everywhere. So if you're looking at an opportunity in that space, I wouldn't consider it niche anymore. At the same time, it still takes storytelling to make sure that people understand what they're eating. But I'd see that as one of the biggest CPG opportunities in the next couple of years. Second misconception from an investor lens is that bootstrap brands couldn't raise money at the seed stage.
People think if someone's bootstrapped, that means that they couldn't raise money?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
I am a big advocate for doing what's best for your brand, not what's best for your friends. And sometimes that's growing at your own pace or using your customers as your investor. And I think it's great if someone can get the traction that they need to sustain the business without raising. But from an investor lens, I hope that anybody listening will look at that brand and say, wow, they did this much without raising money. Imagine what they could do with an investment from my firm.
I will say that when I was fundraising for my seed round last summer, I was being compared, not by angels and individuals, but when I did meet the occasional VC fund, I was being compared to pre-launch companies that had a good idea, maybe some groovy packaging that they had spent a lot of money on, but didn't have any sales. And it was really frustrating, I have to say. It kind of steered me away. I decided not to go really with funds. I was too early probably anyway, and I wasn't looking for enough money, but it was definitely, it kind of kept coming up, and I didn't understand because it felt so apples to oranges. And a bunch of those pre-revenue companies all raised money. And there was a part of me, I have to say, that kind of felt like maybe I missed the boat and I should have done it before, because it was a little harder, because once you have sales, someone's like, why was October, 2 weeks behind, a little lower than it should. There was like more to pick at.
Yeah. It's a really weird dynamic, but it's 100% real.
It is, right? It's like you can sell a dream, but the reality is that very few things just go straight up, 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 right? Especially when there's an OI, and so someone buys product, they'll buy a lot in July and they'll go through it in August, and August won't be as big of a sales month. It's not necessarily that your sales are down. But have you, Stephen, you've seen that dynamic too?
Yeah, and you see it on both sides of food and beverage, but the first like couple million of revenue are so like, you get a big PO in December versus January could like shift your entire revenue mix for the year, right? And so like, I think trying to extrapolate too much from the first chunk, it, there's also just like, you can be the wrong decision to go into a retailer too early just to hit a number, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's different ways you can move things around that. I kind of come from the school of like, have a thesis on the category and the team and what the opportunity looks like, and like make an investment kind of based on that versus like some of these revenue numbers. And a lot of them are functions of course you can grow faster if you raise money before you launch. You have like people on your team and it's like, what you can be doing. And so I have a friend who just closed like $1 million seed round, and he's kind of bootstrapped and doing everything by himself, and it's like super impressive what he's accomplished by himself. But then like investors are like knocking him for not growing fast enough.
Right, exactly.
It's interesting, and it's just kind of like the way the system works. I think it's starting to shift a little bit. You have more, there's been a lot of like M&A activity the last 5 years. So the investor landscape is shifting a little bit more towards kind of former operators or entrepreneurs who sold businesses. And I think they think more like you know, to have a thesis and understand where you can add value versus just purely being like a numbers driven investor.
Right. And maybe get to, you know, profitability as opposed to just like, you know, opening doors, which seems like that was a thing for a while. Okay, Amrit, sorry. Continue. Number three.
Is over-indexing on packaging and pre-launch branding.
Yeah.
And not putting enough focus on your product development, consumer engagement, acquiring customers through partnerships. Stephen and I talk a lot about little things that brands can do when you're on a budget. Maybe you just launched. You can collaborate on all kinds of things digitally to share each other's newsletter lists or Instagram or whatnot. You don't have to go right to ads if you're super early.
Right.
So I think focusing on your product and your path to your position in the market is a better use of time and working capital than spending a third or half of what you've raised from your seed round on the packaging and not the product.
Yeah.
If your product is good, your product could be in a paper bag and
yeah.
people would love it. So I really push companies to focus on the core of your product, and then you can refresh your packaging when you have traction. But
yeah.
it's a waste of everybody's time to spend a large portion of your budget on things that don't lead to sales.
Yeah.
But at the same.
No, I mean, I've now met three or four brands that had to completely scrap those designs and those names and those everything for one reason or another after they spent a good chunk of money on them. And every one of them felt pretty nauseous about it. So that's a very good point.
If you go all the way back on the Olipop Instagram, 2.5 years ago, you'll see there was actually a brand, a packaging pre the packaging that we have now, that Ben and David had, you know, did some focus groups with pre-launch, and it just didn't resonate with people.
Right.
And it's pretty interesting, and a lot of people don't know about that. But
I love it. Did you see the Oatly article? Last week, there was like an Oatly article going around, and it showed Oatly's original packaging.
Oh, yeah, that's crazy.
Which was pretty hard.
It's like
and
black
also,
and red,
I mean,
right?
The RX guys, I mean, their packaging is iconic, and there was a completely different package for the first couple of years. So product. And know your consumer and know your category. That makes a lot of sense. Do you have another one or yeah?
No, those would be my top three. But just to add to that, Stephen and Allison and I, we're all huge branding and packaging nerds. We love good packaging, bright colors, things that stand out on the shelf. But you can still stand out on the shelf and preserve your capital for when you're going to need it for something else.
Totally.
And I think it's most important in packaging to make sure that people understand what they're buying, especially if it has an ingredient that's new to them or they're on a special diet. As long as people can understand what's inside of the package,
yeah.
it doesn't matter if it's pretty enough to be posted on Instagram
and
when
you
launch.
To piggyback on that, so you know, I sort of tell this like when I, you know, climbed 18 mountains to get to school, sort of like this is like I've created this like folklore that I basically, which is true, but we had our cooking school logo. And then I was giving a farmer's market tour and met this woman on the tour who was a graphic designer. And I was like, oh, hey, we're thinking about putting sauces in pouches. Can you take our logo and kind of jerry-rig it to fit on a pouch? And it was, you know, a couple hundred dollars. And that's how we've never spent more than that on logo or, you know, packaging or anything. And to be fair, I've gotten pushback from a couple of retailers. It looks a little too homemade. I've gotten pushback from investors. It doesn't quite look sort of grown up enough. I've definitely gotten the message that we do need a refresh, you know, which I think will happen, you know, in a year or so. But the thing about what's so much fun when you haven't spent a ton of money on your packaging is that you're very open to playing around and trying different things. So we didn't have, we just had, and our first iteration of the pouch, it just said cook with confidence. It didn't say sauce or marinade or dressing. We just kind of assumed that people would know what it is, which is, you know, never assume that a consumer understands anything just because you, it makes perfect sense to you. Especially because we were putting these pouches in the middle of, you know, the dairy set, and no one had any clue what they were. It's kind of amazing that actually as many people did understand what they were. But, you know, every 6 to 8 months or so, we kind of futz around and like try different things on the front, try different things on the back. And if you had spent a ton of money on some sort of, you know, gift from the, you know, marketing gods, you wouldn't feel as comfortable doing that. And I think you'd miss out on a lot of important learnings early on in your life, you know, as a brand. So I think that's a really good point. Stephen, what about you? Do you have one to three sort of things that you would like founders not to mess up?
Yeah, the first thing that I find myself talking about the most, I feel like, is just price point. And despite all these things we talk about and branding and packaging, like price is still the driver of consumer decision making in the grocery store. And it's inherently like I have some cognitive dissonance here, because a lot of like new better for you products are like inherently more expensive, right? Whether it's the production process, the better ingredients. And then the flip side says like to do the most kind of like good, to have the highest impact, in theory you want to kind of like grow as big as possible while preserving like your ingredient integrity and like what you stand for as a brand. But the reality of the situation is kind of the people who need the most help from a health perspective often have, you know, fall on the lower end of the income bands. And so I talk about this with respect to Olipop a lot, and that we're at a $2.49 price point in general. We flex up to like $3 maybe in New York, down to $2.29, you know, in other accounts. But we're like one of the cheapest functional beverages in any better for you beverage set. Most functional beverages are $3.49 to $4.99. And you go, like, well, we're going after soda, right? And like a diet, you can get a Diet Coke for like 50 cents to a dollar almost anywhere. Right. And so, you know, it's tough. It's tough to make the argument that someone who's drinking soda, kind of because they need to from a financial perspective, are going to switch to like a $4.99 kombucha. Right. Whereas, you know, we're $2.49, maybe we'll promote down to 2 for $4. That's a bit, you know, a bit more attainable. It's still more than double the price, right? I'm it's not lost on me, but price is so important. And we, Olipop, David and Ben elected to not go organic on it because we have some kind of obscure ingredients and the prebiotics and some of the botanicals. Like if we were sourcing those, you know, organic, we'd be a $5 price point, and then we're not helping any of the people.
You know, we did a similar, we didn't go organic, one, because we have a couple of farmers, like our, you know, our pepper farmer in Spain is not getting certified USDA, like just not going to go through that process. But there were other things that, you know, there's no reason why a non-GMO version of that particular ingredient is not just as good as the organic capital O version. But that organic capital O version can be 4 to 5 times the price. So if we only chose all organic ingredients, our sauces would be, you know, $15-16, which is obviously not going to work on a grocery store shelf ever. And I mean, I don't know, tell me, I think the consumer is starting to understand that capital O organic doesn't necessarily mean, everything that they want it to be. I think they understand non-GMO a little bit better. I think they understand sourcing, you know, and focus on quality and integrity more than they did. Do you guys have a thought on that?
I feel like that's an awkward question, to be honest. As I think about like conventional retail, broadly speaking, I think a lot of this stuff, again, it's some of these are like nice to haves, but like price matters the most.
Right. That's interesting.
In the grand scheme of things. Yeah.
Amrit, what about your perspective?
I agree with Stephen that price matters. Right now I'm doing a consumer study for a candy brand, and sustainability and organic has come up a lot because it matters to the client. And what I'm hearing from consumers is partly in response to coronavirus, but just in general for their budget, they're leaning towards the natural or non-GMO version versus organic, because they're priced out of organic right now. But if they're at a store that they trust, like a Whole Foods or an Erewhon or their local natural grocery store, they're more than happy to buy the conventional version because they know that that's still a better tomato than what you would find at a big box store.
Right. Yep.
So the grocer has a really important trust layer with all of our products, because their stamp of approval is helping people decide what to buy right now for their families to stay healthy while maintaining their budget. I think some families are spending a little bit less on organic so that they can stock up on other items, or kind of just triaging what's the most important to buy organic. But of course people care, people still care about it, but there's so many layers to what organic means, or safe fruits and vegetables, that I think people have loosened up a little bit about what that means to them.
Let's talk a little bit, because you mentioned the grocery store. I think Amrit and I have talked a lot about how we're grocery store believers, even with COVID. You know, I think a lot of grocery stores, there's a lot of research coming out that a lot of grocery stores are seeing new customers come in that are completely new to them. People are trying things at the grocery level and they're sticking. It's not like everyone's only buying Kraft mac and cheese and potatoes. People are actually trying new brands. It's kind of an interesting time in a way. I mean, definitely an interesting time, but more positive, I think, for emerging brands than maybe I had anticipated. But I know, Stephen, you're also, you know, we've also talked about, you can't just be, you know, grocery, you've got to have direct to consumer, you're probably going to have Amazon. Like, I think we all have gotten the other lesson from COVID that you have to be in every possible channel. What are your thoughts?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. It's probably, my opinions have probably changed in the last 6 months. I would have said maybe a year ago, like, you really need to start one place and focus and own it. And we, you know, Olipop, we launched in grocery, call it September of 2018. We didn't launch even any sort of website until August of 19, and then didn't really start focusing on the e-com until like middle of February this year, which was just like super fortuitous timing. But what we've kind of seen, as you know, obviously some of this totally accelerated by what's happened with COVID, but you know, we started running ads in February. Kind of took us like a month or so to figure out like copy and what type of content works and, you know, all that jazz. And then kind of middle of March, we made some pricing changes on the site and started offering free shipping, and just kind of things just kind of took off. But what I've kind of learned in the last few months is like how important this is. Another, I think people talk about how expensive Facebook and Instagram ads are. Like, yeah, for sure, they've gotten more expensive, but there's so many more people around the country who've just seen our brand now because we've been running ads for 4 months or 5 months. And you know, I get from people all the time, like, I see your brand everywhere, whether it's like, you know, people in LA, you see it in stores, people in New York, as we just launched there about 6 weeks ago. But, you know, we were geo-targeting ads in New York before we even had product there. And we had, you know, launched with By Chloe in New York. And so we've kind of had this like weirdly, you know, effective omni-channel strategy between grocery and some like food service, retail, restaurant, and now e-com, where, you know, we did this big, you know, National Sprouts launch in the end of May, and it's gone, you know, exceedingly well, like far surpassed our expectations or the expectations that Sprouts had set for us.
And that's always good.
It's good, of course. And there's like, you know, we ran a promo. We launched a new flavor with them, which was hugely important. People, it was the only place they could get it, was in the stores. But I would have to argue that like so many more people even just had seen our brand outside of California and and the Pac Northwest because of ads. It's definitely a part of the equation. And then as you kind of move into e-com and just getting back to what you were saying about like kind of key call outs and watch outs, like I had no idea how important customer service was. I'd never been in a customer service function. I'd never really understood what that meant. And, you know, we've kind of turned it into, I kind of view it as a marketing channel for us on the e-commerce side.
Totally.
If anyone takes the time to write you an email or comment on a Facebook ad, whether it's complaining about price point or, you know, something went wrong in the shipping experience, like if someone cares enough to let you know, like you want to make sure you take care of them, right? In one way or another.
Well, so because those people are going to also let people know. I mean, this I learned in brick and mortar very early. You know, the people that were like, my coffee is too hot, my coffee is too cold. Like, those are also the people that will tell their friends, like, you've got to go to this place for coffee. Because they're doing that because they, I mean, unless they're just like a cranky person. But for the most part, like, converting those people into voices that are amplifying you, they're easily converted. You know, because they've already established the fact that they kind of care, which is more than most people do. You know, you're right. Taking the time to write you guys a DM or comment or email or whatever, it's such a great opportunity to really convert that person into like a you know, an ambassador.
Yeah. And we just brought on Eli Weiss, who is at Nugs, running their customer service team. And he's just like incredible. And he's like the most empathetic person I've ever met and just mm-hmm. so above and beyond. And I think treating customer service really as a marketing channel is critical, especially for all these like, so many new brands who hadn't sold online until, you know, March or April and now have like significant e-commerce businesses and, you know, not being caught flat-footed when it comes to customer service. I think a lot of brands just don't have the bandwidth and they just, you know, let Instagram comments and Facebook comments and even emails just kind of fall through the cracks. And I totally understand like people have different, you know, amounts of resources and some people just don't have resources to deal with this, but for those that do, I would treat customer service as like one of the most important
things. I think it's a good marketing channel. B, I think it's great research. You know, if you look at, you know, 10 of the comments in the past month and they are all kind of pointing toward the similar thing, you know, you might have something that you need to address, you know, or if there is a question that keeps coming up that needs to go in your FAQs, you know, and it's I think a lot of this, and I've talked to a couple guests about this, like I think a lot of brands, and I don't know, it's ironic in a way, but I think a lot of brands, they're so in love with their own product that it's very hard for them to hear, whether it's an investor, a buyer, a consumer, a service provider, anything challenging. And they almost get this like defensive, like, well, they don't get it, or they're just a pain in the neck, or and the more that you can kind of open yourself up to all of that, you know, reasonably, the better, because you're just getting so much information, and information is what you need. I mean, Amrit, you talk about this a lot, like you need to know why consumers love your product. You need to know number reason why, 1, 2, and 3. And it can't be why you love your product. You have to do the research to figure out what they love about it. And speaking of that, like, what do you think is the best way for like a brand like ours, where we're not doing a big focus group and we're not spending a lot of money on a consultant? Like, is it just an Instagram story? Why do you love us? Like, what is the best sort of way to get that information? And how have you sort of seen brands use that information well?
Sure. So I would say a brand at your stage or thinking about research for the first time, I would strive to talk to at least one customer a day on the phone. That's not a customer service related issue, but just a 15 to 20 minute conversation with them. Offer them a gift card or a envelope of face value coupons to talk to you. And just hear how they discovered your brand. What other brands are they using alongside of yours? What do they dislike about your brand? I would hope that it would be easier for you to hear what someone dislikes when you ask them directly versus an isolated customer service issue. And maybe someone didn't understand how to use your product and that's why they gave it a bad review. So if you keep hearing, oh, I don't know how to
use it.
I don't know how to use this product, or I took two of your vitamins and I didn't feel anything, but you actually needed to take four, but that wasn't clear, and the font wasn't big enough or whatnot. So if you start to hear people's pain points, whether or not they're isolated situations, you can start to put those in a spreadsheet and kind of categorize them.
I think that's a great idea.
What are we hearing?
I love that.
And when you get a new customer, or you see that someone has purchased more than a few times, just have your team reach out to them. Flag those people. If someone hasn't made a purchase in 6 months directly from your website, reach out to those people as well and say, we'd just like to get to know you, and we're happy to reward you for your time. It doesn't have to be a formal survey. It can really help your team get to know the customer. You can rotate who takes those calls. You can record them anonymously for training purposes, so that everyone on your team knows who your customer is, not just the marketing and R&D department.
I think that's great advice, Stephen.
I monitor all of our Shopify orders, and whenever I see something come in for more than like $200, I'll usually send them a personal email and just thank them for supporting us. And they don't always jump on the phone, but you can get a lot of information just out of a couple of emails. Like, hey, where'd you find us? Like, there's a real guy in Indiana who's like ordered, I don't know, I think he had ordered $800 of product within like the first month of his first order.
Oh my gosh.
Who is this guy? He's like the coolest guy ever. He's like a military veteran, two young girls, like obsessed with Olipop. He's like now bringing our product into the VA, like the Veterans Association in Indianapolis. And it's like, you hear these amazing stories, and it's awesome. And there are also people you can get like product feedback on from, right? Like, oh, we're launching this new flavor. What do you think of this name versus that name?
Mm-hmm.
With this
packaging?
And I love all that.
Okay, guys, thank you so much. So much. Usually I'd be like, what's your best advice? But you've given so much advice that we don't need to do that. Stephen, thank you. Amrit, thank you. Matt, thank you for being the best engineer. And thank all of you guys for listening. And I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.